This episode today is brought to you by Grinding Coffee Co. Grinding Coffee, a Black LGBTQ-owned coffee business that donates a portion of every sale to charity. Coffee is imported from around the world, and they pride themselves on great customer service for a small team. Use promo code PITLANEPARLAY for 13% off your order.
Welcome to a special episode of Pit Lane Parlay. I'm your host, Mike Jokum. Joining me for, I guess it's been probably since late last year, is Frank Santoroski, runs Drafting the Circuits. Ooh, I almost said Driving the Circuits. You can tell it's been a while. But, sir, how are you? We're going to do another lost track here for the first time since probably last November, I think. So how's everything going, man?
Oh, good, man. How's it going with you?
You know, I'm living the dream and hanging out and excited to talk another old racetrack here. I was doing some digging and I wanted to find something. And I know Dale Earnhardt's Lost Track show has talked about this. I did not watch it in advance because I forgot. But Jungle Park Speedway, which is in Bloomingdale, Indiana, one of the premier Midwest racetracks back in the day. It was in operation from, I believe, the mid-1920s until 1960. Also one of the deadliest tracks. As you and I saw, and I'll post this picture on our social media when the episode comes out, the grandstands kind of looked like if you got a gust of wind, they were going to blow away. So not really very well built, obviously, and there was like zero sanctioning. I don't know where you want to start other than that, but I'll turn it over to you and see where we go with this.
Okay. Well, Jungle Park Speedway, actually, you know, although in that picture by today's standards, those grandstands don't look really sturdy by 1926 standards. That was state of the art. I mean, covered grandstands were, a luxury. And so they built a track and they built a little resort up the road from it, a little resort style hotel shaped like a windmill, had a restaurant on the grounds there. And it was in the middle of the woods. It was in a heavily wooded area, thus the name Jungle Park Speedway. Guy that opened the track was Earl Padgett, his name was. He opened it up, started building in 1926. The layout is a half mile and it's almost a circle. It's not quite as circular as, say, a Langhorne,
but it's
definitely closer to a circle than an oval. And the original paving was something that was they would do back then, which was crushed gravel and oil. Oh, wow. And if you recall, the original service for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway was also the crushed gravel and oil before they went ahead and laid the bricks down. In later years, they paved the straightaway, but they kept this gravel in the turns. And they opened up for racing in 1926. They would get 4,000 to 5,000 folks there on a race weekend. And these were open wheel cars of the time. You had some of the bigger names from Indianapolis competed there. You know, Rex Mays, Maury Rose, Howdy Wilcox, Wilbur Shaw, all these guys raced at Jungle Park. But it quickly got a reputation for being, number one, pretty deadly, and number two, pretty rowdy. The crowds there were pretty rowdy. I don't know if it was a bad section of town or what, or if they just had great beer prices. But there's a couple stories that we'll share a little later in the broadcast about some of the crowds there. But they... the early races were, they had some serious banking on this, you know, kind of a smallish oval. So they would get to speeds of, up to 100 miles an hour. And we're talking the 1920s and 30s, you know, whizzing around a 1 mile oval at 100 miles an hour is, for that time, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty quick. The first fatality there was a track worker who was trying to repair a divot in the track while the cars were running, which, This makes no sense to me. The next fatality was a spectator who was crossing the track during a green flag run, which, according to the article I read, was commonplace in the day, but I guess they couldn't get across the track quick enough. You know, just things that if you think by today's standard is just mind-blowing. But there were several driver fatalities over the years. There was 22 fatalities alone in the decade of the 1930s. So,
I'm looking at the banking. The banking is pretty steep, and I think what's also important to note about the banking is there's no wall. So if you kind of miss the banking, you're going into the trees.
And the trees are the sort of things that killed a lot of those drivers, you know.
Yeah.
And there's no banking, no walls. The grandstands, they had like chicken wire, keeping the, in front of the grandstands, which, and another spectator fatality happened when a car hit a fence post and sent that fence post right through the chicken wire into the crowd. It was a pretty dangerous place, but also a pretty rowdy place. I was reading some stories about, people that are lighting firecrackers in other people's shoes in the stands here, just thinking that's kind of fun. there's a great story where everybody's drinking some beer and, a car crashes, flips over, catches on fire. Which, of course, there's no safety crew, no fire truck on hand. So the spectators are dumping bottles of beer on the burning car, trying to put the fire out. I mean, if you could just imagine how disorganized this sounds, right? But yet they attracted some of the greatest drivers of the day. And, and again, the sanctioning was supposedly through the Wabash Valley Racing Association, but I guess they were pretty loose with number one safety and number two, any kind of rules or procedure. There's another great story I read about, a guy who was there racing, and this fella, he's one of the, 86 years old now, one of the last living guys to have actually raced there. He was there at, they do hold a reunion at the track every year, which we can talk about in a bit. And he was there and he was talking, he said, the guy doing the timing and scoring, he happened to notice the guy didn't actually have a stopwatch. He had a silver dollar in his hand and was pretending it was a stopwatch, thinking he was fooling everybody. And just eyeballing the speed. So, we're pretty spoiled with digital timing and scoring, no one's going to fool us with the silver dollar, but, if you doubt that early drivers were brave, I mean, here you go.
Yeah, this is everything about this track just screams crazy. There was something I was just looking at. There was one day there were buzzards that went into the stands in the middle of a race. There was a small hotel that was built on the track grounds. It burned down. There's also a restaurant that was supposed to look like a windmill. It's still there, but obviously is no longer in use. Even just looking at the.
Yeah, that's the windmill restaurant, the hotel. That's the resort that was, in the 20s, it was. Pretty fancy place to stay, but time is taking its toll on those buildings.
So I know it was around for a while, closed for a little bit, and then I think it opened back up for like a one night like shootout to end the track career, right?
Right. So what they did, the track closed in 19, it opened in 27, it closed in 41. Of course, every track in the country closed in 1941 due to World War II. They got up and racing again in 1945, and they actually had a pretty long stretch with no fatalities until they hosted some stock cars there and a guy lost his life there. But, the crowds started to diminish, they've been in operation since the 20s. So they closed in 1955, I believe, but they wanted to revive the track in 1960. But the track service itself was kind of in a bit of a bad way. We're talking some pavement on the straights and still got this crushed gravel, but that pavement had been sitting vacant for 5 years. So they built a quarter mile dirt oval inside the existing oval.
Interesting.
And attempted to revive the track and get back to racing. They held one race there. It was a sprint cup race, or, you know, a sprint car race, not a sprint cup, a sprint car race. And during that race, a car hit a divot in the track, flipped end over end right into the grandstands, and killed a spectator. And then that was the end. That was the end of racing at Jungle Park Speedway.
Yeah, I feel that sounds like a scene from Driven, to be totally honest with you. But they were 60 years ahead of their time there, but probably a good reason to close the track at that point, because you're either going into the stands, going into the trees, or I see here looking at this map, you're ending up in looks like a river or a creek or something along the back there. So I feel
there were cars that ended up in the creek. Yeah.
I feel like that's the best place to end up out of the three of those options, which is not a good thing.
yeah. So, but in the ensuing years, I mean, there were some folks that had bought the property and they had no plans to revive racing and all, but they did run a canoeing business. So they needed that property as access to that creek that goes into the river.
Yeah.
So they use that as a launching place, but I think they're no longer in the canoeing business, but they do still own the property, and they host a reunion there every fall, where people bring out some vintage cars and some of the folks that remember the racing there come out, and they get like 1,000 people, and it's from what I understand, it starts out as a Facebook event.
Okay.
And then people show up for that, and they bring out some classic cars, and people share stories, and it's kind of a once a year kind of deal. But there are still a few folks that remember the racing there and the times there, both good and bad. I mean, you got to admit, despite all the fatalities, it sounded like a lot of people really had a good time there.
I mean, it was rowdy. It seemed like a good party atmosphere. I read something that one time a car was on fire, and because there was no safety vehicles or safety or fire extinguishers, fans in the stands actually attempted to, I don't know if they were successful, put out a fire with the beer that they had in their hands, which is, again, just goes to show how nuts this place was back in the day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.
Hey there, my name is Michael Laminato, and this is Pit Pass F1, a brand new podcast that'll take you closer to the action of the world's most prestigious motorsport. From Monaco to Miami and Australia to Azerbaijan, Pit Pass F1 is on the ground and has you covered. Esteemed F1 journalists Julianne Serasoli and Chris Medland will take you inside the sport every round. They'll keep you up to date with the latest news breaking in Formula One and the most influential views shaping the world of Grand Prix racing. Every Friday, we'll be bringing you a track guide and race preview, and Chris and Drew will be in your feed every morning from Saturday through to Monday to keep you up to date on all the day's action on and off the track. So if you want to be in the know on the latest in Formula One, subscribe wherever you get your favourite podcasts and visit us at evergreenpodcasts.com. Pit Pass F1, a brand new show for Evergreen Podcasts.
Let me see here. I'm looking at old pictures. It looks like a real look. I would love to go to the reunion, especially once I'm out in the Indy area. I was actually in Wabash last week. So I would love to, I'm assuming the Wabash River Valley is not far from there, but then again, I'm no geography expert on there. The old sprint cars that are there, there's not much of the track left from what I can see here on the video or the pictures. That windmill restaurant is about it. Some old signs that have fallen down. Fencing, which is clearly rusted and fallen over. And maybe
I think they like the entrance, the big kind of arch over the entrance. That's the Jungle Park Speedway is still there.
Yeah.
It's in bad shape, but it's still standing. And there's also, there is a state of Indiana historical marker right there on the site. So, you know, the state does recognize that as a historical site.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I definitely, out of the lost tracks that we've talked about, this is probably one of the ones you can actually go on the grounds and check out what's left. There's some cool photos. This is speedwayandroadhistory.com. I'll share this in the episode notes or social media, but is there anything else that we missed from this epic old track?
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of, I was trying to find some records of wins and losses.
Yeah, there's not too much I can find there,
but a lot of those, you know, because they weren't sanctioned by USAC or weren't sanctioned by AAA, a lot of those records just don't exist. So you're kind of relegated to looking up old newspaper articles from the time and whatnot. Like I said, I did see a couple famous names in there. I think there was a guy named Earl Cox. Maybe that's right. Maybe that's wrong. Who was the guy who won the most races there?
Yeah.
It's funny that maybe that's the name. Maybe that's not. It's the one thing I didn't write down.
we're gonna pretend it's his name.
Yeah, sure. You know, why not?
Yeah, it's
one of those places that people fondly remember. And again, it was one of the premier facilities in the 1930s. You know, when racing was still rather young, they would, you know, like I said, draw 4,000 to 5,000 people.
Yeah, it's a wild place to think about.
Oh, it was like, also one of the first tracks with lights.
Interesting. All right.
And this this is the other story I wanted to, the story about the rowdy crowds. So there was a time when they're getting set for the main event, the race, and the promoter kind of casually announced to the drivers there that the announced purse of $700 would only be $400. Which caused the drivers to refuse to race. They started packing up their, you know, packing up their cars on their little trailers and heading out, which really angered the fans. And the fans ended up damaging the lighting system, tearing down part of one of the grandstands and tearing down a bit of the fencing that they did have there. So it turned into a bit of a riot. So
good God. You know, yeah, so the last thing I'll end with is more about if you want to go visit over there. There's limited parking off the entrance of U.S. Highway 41 and no trespassing and a beware of dog sign. I don't know if that's supposed to mean much other than maybe they have dogs patrolling, but metal barrier prohibits vehicles, but doors on the wooden gate are typically wide open. So that's pretty cool that they, you know, understand history and allow you to check it out. Most of it's just grass at this point. I don't think there's any actual pavement of sorts left in any picture that I can find. I don't know if you found anything different, but
really, I was reading in an article that if you kind of like dig into the grass a little bit, that gravel and stuff is still there. Because you can, they say if you look real close, you can still see the profile of the track. And if you just kind of like dig into the grass a little bit, it's the crushed gravel is still under there, but not highly visible. You kind of, you know, got to seek it out.
Yeah, makes sense. And so, yeah, I think this is one of the more unique tracks that we've talked about. Obviously, it's decently known. Indy Star wrote about it 6 or 7 years ago. I vaguely remember that. And obviously, Dale Jr. took his TV show there in the last couple of years. But one that I definitely want to get to in 2022. Maybe I'll bring GoPro and take some video and have some fun, and who knows. But yeah, Frank, I appreciate you hanging out and doing a quick Lost Tracks with me here. We'll definitely be doing a couple more of these in the off seasons. We all try to stay busy, but yeah, man, I appreciate your help and your expertise as always.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on here, man. And we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, man. I appreciate the time and have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, you too.
I'm Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They are able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcast.